Well, welcome to our Sunday morning service. And as you know, we're actually doing this on Saturday. It's going to be really interesting to see how it all works, especially the interactive part. And just so you know, I'm going to be watching me with you on Sunday morning. So if you feel moved to interact and mention the fact that video does indeed add 20 pounds to one, just know that I will be reading that in real time, and I will probably respond somewhat sarcastically. Or I may become horribly depressed and dive into the bag of M&Ms that I was able to get at the store. No toilet paper, no potatoes, no milk, no eggs. But the candy aisle was full to brimming, as was the aisle containing wine, beer, and liquor. I'm not sure what that says about our community. Maybe in times of crisis, we gravitate towards a healthier lifestyle. Well, that's good. I'm trying to look for blessings wherever we can. But in full disclosure, I did buy a bag of M&Ms, and I'm not afraid to use them. So what a crazy week. Between the shortages at the grocery store, the mandatory 6-foot social distancing, and just an aside, if you noticed that Ashley and Chris were closer than 6 feet, they're married, so we gave them a pass. Well, I've been transitioning an office full of high-maintenance attorneys and staff members into a work-and-home environment. And that may sound simple, but it really is not. And it's a good thing my hair is already white, because it's been quite a week. It seems like the world's been turned on its axis, doesn't it? I mean, all the things we've taken for granted are either not available or they have to be disinfected to the extent that disinfectant is available, which is a whole other issue. And then we listen to the news, and it seems like it stirs up an already boiling pot even more than it already is. It's hard to know what we can count on, and there's sort of an overarching atmosphere of doom, don't you think? It's a real time of deconstruction. And here we are. I, at one point, had said I'd rather be set on fire than speak in public. And I've always hated having my picture taken or being on camera. So if a zombie happens to walk in here, it's going to be the trifecta, and I will die of a heart attack. But that would be, you know, good for streaming live, I guess. But here I am pretending you're all here with me. But likely you're home in your bunny slippers sipping coffee, eating whatever you were able to find in the supermarket. Yeah, it's a time of deconstruction, but we carry on. And you know, deconstruction is not a new thing. It's happened ever since the beginning of time, really. It just has a way of knocking people out of their status quo. Our passage today from the lectionary takes place during another time of deconstruction, and that was for Israel. It was a time when they wanted to transition from a sort of a theocracy to a government pattern upon what their neighbors were doing. Everyone else had a king, and Israel wanted one as well. But before we get to the passage, I want to give you just a tiny bit of historical background. Israel had begged God for a king, and God had finally reluctantly relented and given them a king named Saul. And Saul, as you know, was kind of the king's king. I mean, he was seemingly perfect. He was strong. He was a mighty warrior. Perfect pedigree. He had everything. Plus a couple other things. A little bit of insanity, a little bit of paranoia. So Samuel, the prophet who had anointed Saul at God's direction, had a bit of crisis of faith. Did I hear right? Is everything I believed in a lie? Am I a prophet at all? Where is my firm foundation? Everything Samuel knew, he began to question. And here's what happened next. I'm reading from 1 Samuel 16, 1 through 13. God addressed Samuel. So how long are you going to mope over Saul? You know I've rejected him as king over Israel. Fill your flask with anointing oil and get going. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've spotted the very king I want among his sons. I can't do that, said Samuel. Saul will hear about it and kill me. Because you see, Samuel had recognized that Saul was a bit paranoid. God said, take a heifer with you and announce, I've come to lead you in worship to God with this heifer as a sacrifice. Make sure Jesse gets invited, and I'll tell you what to do next. I'll point out the one you are to anoint." Samuel did what God told him. When he arrived at Bethlehem, the town fathers greeted him, but apprehensively. "Is there something wrong?" Because see, prophets didn't normally come with good news. They didn't normally come and say, "Hey, you guys are doing great." No, they usually came with a different message altogether. But Samuel said, "Nothing's wrong. I've come to sacrifice this heifer and lead you in worship to God. Prepare yourselves, be consecrated, and join me in worship." He made sure that Jesse and his sons were also consecrated and called to worship. When they arrived, Samuel took one look at Eliab and thought, "Here he is. This is God's anointed. But God told Samuel, "Looks aren't everything. Don't be impressed with his looks and stature. I've already eliminated him. God judges persons differently than humans do. Men and women look at the face. God looks into the heart." So then Jesse called up Aminadab and presented him to Samuel, and Samuel said, "This man isn't God's choice either." Now, just an aside, I named my son David after King David, and so I think he and I are very glad that Abinadab was not the guy, because then that would have been his name, and he would have never forgiven me for it. So Jesse moved on, or Jesse presented Shammah. Samuel said, "Nope, this isn't the man either." Jesse presented all seven sons to Samuel, and Samuel was blunt with Jesse. "God hasn't chosen any of these." Then he said to Jesse, "Is that it? Are there no more sons?" Jesse responded, "Well, yeah, there's the runt, but he's out tending sheep." Samuel ordered Jesse, "Go get him. We're not moving from this spot until he's here." Jesse sent for him. He was brought in, and he was the very picture of health, bright-eyed, good-looking. God said, "Up on your feet, anoint him. This is the one." You can see the excitement in God's voice. Samuel took his flask of oil and anointed him, with his brothers standing around watching. Now there's a picture. Can you imagine these other large brothers looking down on the runt, thinking, "Seriously, him?" Well, that's what happened. The Spirit of God entered David like a rush of wind, God vitally empowering him for the rest of his life. Samuel left and went home to Ramah. God looks on the inside. On September 8, 1504, in Florence, Italy, Michelangelo unveiled a statue he'd been working on for more than 2 years, the statue of David, the runt. Michelangelo was only 26 years old in 1501, but he was already the most famous sculptor around and the best paid one. He accepted the challenge with enthusiasm to sculpt a large-scale David sculpture and worked constantly for over 2 years to create one of the most breathtaking masterpieces in gleaming white marble. Michelangelo chose to depict King David before he was king and before the battle with Goliath. He was alert and ready for contact. He created David from a piece of marble that had been twice discarded by other sculptors. So I have a picture of the sculpture here, although for obvious reasons, if you've seen it, I did not include all of him. But here is David, the runt. Now, if that's a runt, have you ever stopped to think, what must Jesse's other sons have looked like? Wow. I mean, just wow, really. And that kind of illustrates the point I want to make. I've fallen into the trap that God addresses here. I've looked on the outside of David, and I am truly impressed. But God looked on the inside and was even more impressed with what he found there. Well, what does he see? What do you think God saw in David when he looked at him? Do you think he saw the brash but probably pouty kid who had to watch the sheep while his brothers were all making names for themselves, becoming Saul's mighty warriors? Do you think God saw the king who would send a husband of his intended paramour to the front lines of battle and then withdraw the rest of the troops so that husband would die? Do you think God saw the king who would take a census of his kingdom so as to solidify in his own mind what a mighty king he was? Or do you think God saw the youth who looked out into the fields before him and said, "The Lord is my shepherd, I have everything I need"? The king, who upon being confronted with his transgressions, immediately turned back to God. What indeed did God see when he looked at David the runt, soon to become David the king? And what do you think he sees when he looks at you? And here's where I want to turn to a little bit of theology. There's a doctrine that's woven its way into denominational theologies called the doctrine of original sin. Bob mentioned it a couple weeks ago, and it got me to thinking, where did it come from? What is its history? Which takes us to the year 664 and to the synod conveyed by Oswy, king of Northumbria. The purpose of the synod, which is basically a collection of religious leaders who wrestle with issues, was this. There were two competing theologies that had arisen over a couple of centuries that were causing strife in the church, especially in the British Isles. One was Celtic in nature and the other Roman. The Celtic stream had been propounded a couple hundred years ago by a man named Pelagius, and he deferred to the authority of St. John, and it was modeled after the image of St. John leaning on the breast of Jesus at the Last Supper, where they talked about him actually listening to the heartbeat of God. Stop and think about that image for a moment. The Roman Catholics, on the other hand, deferred to the authority of St. Peter, who had become a symbol of faithful action and outward unity. And Augustine was squarely in the latter camp. Well, Oswy's synod decided in favor of the Roman mission, which became the authorized religion of the land, while the Celtic mission became sort of in decline, but it didn't die, fortunately. The roots of this controversy really began a couple hundred years earlier, as I said, in the 4th century, with Pelagius, who was a firm proponent of the Celtic stream of spirituality. Since his teaching tended to go against the orthodoxy of the day, he came under quite a bit of scrutiny and even some condemnation. You see, Pelagius did and thought rather scandalous things, which may be why I like him. He was deeply influenced by the Celtic love of nature. He saw in nature the expression of God's presence among us. Rather than disdaining the Druidic traditions of worshiping nature, he introduced God to them as the creator of all that they held holy. And the Trinitarian God then became the object of most of their worship instead of what had been created. But Pelagius didn't stop there. He taught women to read scripture. He held the conviction that the newborn child held the image of God. He taught that God's image is to be found in every person, male and female. And that was certainly different for that day. To top it off, he was taller and bigger than most men of his age, causing even the saintly Jerome to comment that he walked at the pace of a turtle, and that he was stupid from eating too much Scottish porridge. And then there was the matter of his hairstyle. His tonsure was long at the top and shaved around the edges, as opposed to the approved Roman tonsure about being shaved at the top and growing hair around the edges. These were scandalous things in that time. Well, Pelagius felt that our deepest desires, that of our true self in today's vernacular, are for God and for good. These express themselves in our conscience, our inner capacity to know right from wrong, and are rooted in the original righteousness of the soul and in the goodness of the image in which we were made. In other words, we, as the rest of creation, were created good. Pelagius went on to say this, "We do not defend the good nature to such an extent that we claim it cannot do evil. We merely try to protect it from an unjust charge, so that we may not seem to be forced to do evil, through a fault in our nature. He continued to say that what makes it difficult for us to do good is that we have such a long habit of doing wrong things, which has infected us from childhood, and it corrupts us little by little. So it seems somehow to have acquired the forts of nature, but he didn't believe that it actually did. The doctrine of original sin, on the other hand, concludes that as the result of Adam and Eve's fall and the bite of the apple, man and women were inherently evil and passed that on to their children from birth, and that they remain in a state of effective damnation until such a time as they are either baptized, if you're in the Catholic Church, or until they become born again in the evangelical tradition. It goes further to indicate that God, who is good, cannot look upon evil, and therefore, Jesus' death on the cross was necessary sacrifice that would enable God to look upon us with anything other than wrath. This line of theology did not actually arise until around 312 AD, at the time of Constantine's conversion to Christianity. Now, to what extent Constantine actually converted is something of a debate. On the one hand, he established Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. But, on the other hand, he and his descendants retained the title Pontifex Maximus, or guardian of the Roman cults. In other words, pagan worship was still allowed to thrive, even after the Edict of Milan. However, Christianity was certainly tolerated to a degree, and as such, it held great attraction to the governing empire. You see, the empire was previously under what's called Pax Romanus, or Romana, which was a period of militarily enforced Roman peace. And that lasted up until the mid-200s. After that, there was a bit of chaos. And the marriage of church and state that resulted from the Edict of Milan embraced the Christian ideals of salvation based partially on obedience. And that was very attractive to Rome. They could kind of conscript God into it. In fact, they were more than happy to promote the notion of God as the authoritarian who saw the evil of man and demanded obedience. Obedience to God, obedience to state. God, in essence, became something akin to the absent father who the mother used as an absent control device for her wayward children. You just wait till your father gets home. Well, Augustine had far more supporters than did Pelagius, and despite being found innocent of heresy in two separate trials, Pelagius was finally found guilty of something, and that was disturbing the peace. And shortly thereafter, based on that one accusation, he was excommunicated by the Roman Church. Thereafter, the Celtic stream of Christianity, with its emphasis on God in everything, its love of nature and of mankind, its beautiful image of listening for the heartbeat of God and turning into our conscience, faded away and essentially was relegated to a tiny part of Ireland and Scotland and then into the desert communities where many of the religious leaders went to get away from Rome. And we were left with visions of an angry God, one who could not stand to look upon us. And this infected theology kind of insidiously as an undercurrent. It was left unchecked because it was so practical, and it was a great control device, honestly. And after several hundred years, here's kind of what it looked like. And I'll show you a picture of Jonathan Edwards, who was a missionary, a theologian, honestly a brilliant man. And here he is, his picture, where he looks a little like he's been baptized in lemon juice, don't you think? And I suppose when I get to heaven and I meet Jonathan Edwards, he's going to say, seriously, you used that picture? Because I'm sure he had a lot of good things to say as well. But there was one sermon that he gave that has stopped.
We need to rewind.
Two.
Prior to this.
Okay.
Looking at
You were so wrapped up in my teaching that you just...
Yeah. So let's do this. Where are you at on... So go back to the previous slide, Adam.
I'll go back far enough where I can slice it in.
Let's see. This is the part that I haven't done.
Oh, where are you at right now? Sorry.
I'm in here. So...
So this is what you've already done?
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back to this, however, Christianity.
Okay.
And then that would be the previous slide. Yeah, that should be plenty.
Okay.
Sorry, Jane.
That's all right.
Try not to... Oh, you're doing good.
Should I count or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Do the 3, 2, 1, and then go.
Pause. Okay. 3, 2, 1. However, Christianity was certainly tolerated by decree, and as such, it held a great attraction to the governing empire. You see, the empire had previously enjoyed what was called Pax Romana, a period of militarily enforced peace up until the mid-200s. After that, there was a bit of chaos, and the marriage of church and state that resulted from the Edict of Milan, which embraced the Christian ideals of salvation, based partially on obedience, was very attractive to Rome, as you can imagine. In fact, they were more than happy to promote the notion of God as an authoritarian who saw evil of man and demanded obedience. God, in essence, became something akin to the absent father who the mother uses as a control device for her wayward children. You just wait till your father gets home. Well, Augustine had far more supporters than did Pelagius, and despite being found innocent of heresy in 2 separate trials, Pelagius was finally found guilty of something, which was disturbing the peace. And shortly thereafter, the church jumped upon that and excommunicated him. Thereafter, the Celtic stream of Christianity, with its emphasis on God and everything, its love of nature and mankind, its beautiful image of listening for the heartbeat of God and tuning into our consciences, faded away essentially to a tiny area of Ireland and Scotland, and also... if you've heard of the desert fathers and mothers who escaped from Rome and went into the desert, they carried it with them as well. And we were left with visions of an angry God, one who could not stand to look at us. It infected theology kind of insidiously in undercurrents. It was left unchecked because it was practical, and it was a great control device. And several hundred years later, here's what it looked like. I have a picture of a man called Jonathan Edwards here. He was a missionary, a theologian, a brilliant man, and he wrote many, many things, a lot of them really good. This picture, he looks like he was baptized in lemon juice, though, don't you think? And I have this feeling when I get to heaven, he's going to mention this day to me, and he's going to say, seriously, you had to show them that picture? Well, it illustrates my point. So sorry, Jonathan. In one of his writings, he sort of epitomized the doctrine of original sin. Listen to this. It comes from a sermon he wrote called Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. The God that holds you over the pit of hell, much as one holds a spider or some loathful insect over the fire, abhors you and is dreadfully provoked. His wrath toward you burns like fire. He looks upon you as worthy of nothing else but to be cast into the fire. He is of purer eyes than to bear to have you in his sight. You are 10,000 times more abominable in his eyes than the most hateful, venomous serpent is in ours. Now, if you don't have time to listen to the whole sermon, don't stop here. It doesn't stop there. What does this mean to us? Well, the doctrine of original sin is a bit demoralizing, don't you think? It sets us on a very shaky foundation. On the one hand, we're told that God is love and that he loves us and nothing can separate us from that love. But on the other hand, we are told that he so hates the sin within us that he can't stand to look at us. You know, honestly, I don't believe that. The God I know loves me. And when I peel the layers of junk on that I've massed upon my my soul to protect myself, my most authentic self is his beloved child. I mean, think of your child when they're starting to learn to dress themselves and they come in the most appalling outfits. We don't dislike them. We don't say, you look so horrible, I can't bear to look at you. We kind of laugh and we think about the child underneath the appalling outfit and we just love them absolutely. I think God's like that. I look at Jonathan Edwards' diatribe and a tiny yet growing voice inside me rises up in opposition. Because I know this, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have everlasting life. That is not a God who dangles me over the pit of hell like a spider on a string. And if it was, if ever there was a verse in the Bible that would speak to the wrath of God, don't you think it would have been there? For God was so angry at the world that he had to kill his Son so that he could stand to look at us and it's all our fault? Well, the good news is it doesn't say that at all. And everything that Jesus said and taught cries out in opposition. But let's look back to Augustine. Is he all wrong? I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I think after all these years, we need to let Pelagius and Augustine become friends. There are elements of both ways of thinking. It's a real case of both and, I think. And one theology is made stronger by the inclusion of the other, and vice versa. Righteousness is only righteousness when it arises out of a foundation of absolute love of God. And reveling in our belovedness only works if it breathes out obedience. Righteous acts without the love quickly becomes legalistic bondage. But steeping in the love of God becomes stagnant unless it expresses itself in love to those around us. Now, may I just pause here and say straight out, I've not thoroughly explored the theologies of Pelagius, Augustine, or Jonathan Edwards, for that matter. I suspect there are things I would agree with each of them, and probably things I would not. So, in my comparisons, I don't intend to say that one was all right and one was all wrong. I just took one element of their differences that illustrates the point. So for those of you with a theological bent, please don't challenge me on, but what about when Augustine said thus and so? What about when Pelagius said this? Well, likely I'm going to say, I don't know. I'll be glad to look at it. But mostly I'm not going to have an opinion on the subject, so we can just let that rest. And I don't necessarily solely identify with the Celtic stream of spirituality, although there are elements there that I just love. I also draw from other streams of spirituality. I find that once I hang my hat upon one, I miss out on the blessings afforded by others. Well, let's go on. What's it like to be loved? Do you remember some months ago I brought out my Russian Matryoshka doll? I couldn't say it then, can't say it now. Some things never change. It's a nesting doll. And I talked about how we have a tiny person inside of us, our true self, who we have buried in defenses and counter-defenses in order for us to live comfortably in the world. And sooner or later, we come buried in these constructed layers to a point where our true selves are pretty much lost. We spend our lives trying to be loved for who we are, but we don't really know who we are. In fact, there's another piece to this sad puzzle. We long to be loved or accepted or have worth, and look for those things from external sources, from the people around us who are having the same issues themselves. So the hole we long to fill doesn't get filled by people, and we begin to look for it in other sources, things, food, drug, alcohol, anything to fill the pain. But what if we spent some time digging beneath all the junk we've piled onto ourselves and begin to see him or her the way God sees us? A good exercise is this, I think. When someone pushes one of your buttons, before you react, ask yourself, what button just got pushed and what's beneath it? For instance, I'm driving along and I make a right-hand turn to where I'm going. And Ben, my husband, says, why did you turn that way? His tone indicates that he thinks I've turned the wrong way. And I make the assumption that what's underneath that is he thinks I'm pretty stupid. That makes me angry, so I snap at him. Now, of course, it never really happens like that. But let's dial back pre-snap. What button just got pushed? Well, I hate turning left in traffic unless there's a light or a stop sign. I have this gut feeling that a car is going to zoom out from nowhere, broadside me, and I'm going to die a horrible, bloody death on the side of the road. I'm kind of short, so I don't have the clear view that some taller people might have, so that makes me a little insecure with my driving. I also have the need to feel competent, to be seen as intelligent, resourceful, wise, and a capable woman. That need is based on the underlying fear that I'm not any of those things. You see, inside I see myself as insecure, learning disabled, frightened, and a little girl. So Ben's question, no matter what his motivation, set off skyrockets aimed at all those places of insecurity. They ignited and spewed forth like a volcano. Now, I didn't necessarily want those things at the forefront. I'm happier when they're buried. But taking a moment to explore rather than react is kind of a good exercise. Okay, now that all these things are out in the open and I've excavated a bit, I've become aware of my shadow side raising its ugly head. Instead of snapping at Ben, maybe it would have been better to acknowledge what was actually happening in me and bring that before God. Nothing huge and elaborate. Maybe something as simple as, wow, God, did you see that? Like he didn't. It just hit all my raw places. Can you touch those, bring healing to me, and help me to see myself as you see me? Help me to receive your love. It tends to calm the volcano. And if God loves me, truly loves me, and doesn't just tolerate me because he has to, because I said the magic words at the end of the four spiritual laws, it makes such a difference. I can access him, have the confidence it talks about in Hebrews, that I can boldly approach his throne. I can climb up on his lap, snuggle up against him, and listen to his heartbeat. I can bring my questions, my concerns, and shortcomings to him. I can ask him to touch and heal my raw places. And when I get off his lap, I'm more likely to, and in fact, I want to, follow his ways instead of my own. And if God truly loves me like that, I want to share that love with others, not in words of condemnation, but in words and deeds of grace and mercy and love. That is so needed right now. In our world that has been turned upside down by a tiny organism called COVID-19. The love of God doesn't make any sense, really. In fact, the reason that the image of the wrathful God tends to stick is that that's how we would do things. Disobedience makes us angry. Ask any boss or any parent. But God's heart toward disobedience is different, I think. Our disobedience breaks his heart because he sees how it affects us, the devastation that it causes in those he loves so much. It breaks his heart because he hates having this gulf between us and himself. I think one of the most poignant verses in the whole Bible is when God looked for Adam and Eve in the garden after they ate the apple. And he said, "Where are you?" It is the same longing, the same sense of loss that we see in the New Testament, in the parable of the prodigal son and the father looking out the window, longing for his son, saying, "Where are you?" These are not pictures of a wrathful God. These are pictures of a God who loves us, who cherishes us, who longs for unbroken communion with us. Genesis shows us what happened, but the parable of the prodigal son showed us the heart of God. In this time of uncertainty, we need to focus on this picture of God, not one who dangles us over the pit of hell, but one who gathers us into his arms, who covers us with his hand, who shelters us from the storm. We don't need to ask ourselves, what sin must have been committed for God to allow this to happen? That's not the right question. The better question is, how would God want us to live in the midst of what we're currently facing? How can we show his love to others at this time of deconstruction with a 6-foot barrier between us when the thing we most long for is connection, a loving touch, and a hug? These are good questions to ask. We're in the season of Lent, a time of contemplation, of considering Jesus in the end of his earthly ministry in the flesh, his death, his resurrection. These are good things to think about. As we enter the season, when we see images of Jesus on the cross, let's see it for what it truly is, the ultimate act of love, not an expiation of wrath. God looks on the inside. He sees you as his beloved. He looks upon you with joy, with pride, with compassion, with grace, with mercy, and a love that covers everything. That is our foundation. That is the thing on which we can count. That is the thing that gives us hope. That is the thing out of which everything else we feel, we think, we do arises. It enables us to actually live from the inside out, from that place of security and confidence, so that we can breathe. We can slough off the completely unnecessary layers of junk that we've been hiding under. Live like that. A life that the gates of hell cannot stand against. Let's live like that, in freedom, in confidence, standing on a love that fights for us, that stands for us, that pursues us. That's what the love of God does. Thank you.